Broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University, this is WSDL Ocean City, NPR News Talk 90.7, putting Delmarva first. It's time for Delmarva Today with your host, Don Rush.
An icy cold beginning of the year with wind chill factors plunging below zero. And while Delmarvans have been huddling in the warmth of their homes, there is another group that does not have it so lucky. That is the homeless. Welcome to Delmarva Today. This is Don Rush. The last national count for the homeless in 2011-2012 found an estimated 633,000 people were experiencing homelessness in America. And the majority of those identified as homeless were staying in emergency shelters or transitional housing. But 38% were still without shelter in places ranging from the streets and cars to abandoned buildings. Here on Delmarva, when the winter weather hits, local churches do go into action with the Community Emergency Shelter Project here in Salisbury. About 12 churches have signed up to take on those who are in need. In addition, there is, of course, the Christian Shelter and Joseph's House. Our guests this morning are sisters Virginia Peckham and Marilyn Bouchard from Joseph's House and John Clisby from the Talbot Interfaith Shelter. Welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Well, let me ask you this. One of the things that's been remarkable about this particular year is that just days ago we were talking about some very icy conditions. I mean, with wind chill factors that were below zero, sometimes as much as like 10 or 14 below zero. So I'm just going around the room here first. And John, I'll start with you. What did you see during that time, and how did the homeless cope with this kind of extreme weather? Because that's not normal here on Delmarva, even from
It's not normal,
anywhere.
But it happened. Certainly, that led to even more people trying to make contact with us and see what kinds of resources were available where they could find shelter. But the irony is that we have that kind of demand almost all the time, year round. People are seeking shelter, whether it's bitterly cold or not. And just the first half of the year, like 215 people or so inquire about the possibility of shelter. So there's been a spike in requests in the last week or so. And unfortunately, there aren't that many options. That's one of the real challenges that we work together a lot throughout Talbot County and here in this area and with churches and with other organizations trying to find the physical capacity to provide the shelter and the meals that people need. But I think all of us recognize that the capacity is not nearly sufficient to meet the need. And when you see it come up, especially in the last couple of weeks, it just stuns you know, how little we have available right now to meet the demand that's there.
Sister Virginia, what when you saw this cold snap come and hit, I mean, what was that experience like? I mean, as John has indicated, he seemed to get a lot more inquiries than he had ever before, obviously. But I mean, that's a really unusual event.
Yes, well, in the hospitality room where I work, it's a day program. We have certain core group of guys and women we see all year round, and lots of new people have been coming in the cold weather. On the very cold night, we were concerned because it was just one day before the church program was about to start up. So a church and an organization called Halo both opened their doors a day early and were able to accommodate our guys and women, some of whom stay outside or in their cars a lot of the time. And so we were really, really grateful and delighted. And they, as far as I could tell, they all, pretty much all, made use of those facilities and found them very welcoming and comfortable. So we were relieved at that. And now they all seem to be making use of the church program.
Sister Marilyn, what was your reaction when you saw this, particularly this? I mean, we could all see the cold coming. I mean, across the little maps and everything we saw on television. What did you anticipate, and what was that like for you, the people you saw?
Similar to Sister Virginia.
Yeah.
you're always extra concerned when that cold snap sets in. And yet we also know that despite the cold weather shelters, there are those people who tent it or, you know, do it outside or do it in their car. We know some who have had seven blankets both below them and above them with possibly a propane heater to give them a little bit of warmth. And one person in particular lost his propane heat overnight, so all they could do is just huggle, you know.
What happened to that person?
Down.
What happened to that person? I mean,
they lived through it, you know. They survived. They're amazingly survivors in the first place, but cold as ice when it came to coming the next day and trying to find some warmth.
They looked really miserable. We do hand out gloves and hats and thermal underwear and these kind of warm, these reflector blankets, and mm-hmm. we try to provide them with everything that they need if they are living in their car or living outside. So,
how viable is it to particularly in a cold like that? I mean, even in one's car. I mean, to say nothing about trying to huddle in a sleeping bag or whatever. How viable is that, and particularly with that kind of weather? I mean, when we saw instances where people told us, don't go outside for very long, otherwise you can get frostbite or you could freeze to death. I mean, that's how cold it actually was. How viable was that for those people to be out there? I mean, did we lose anybody? I didn't hear anything about any deaths, but
I'm not aware of any deaths in this area, for example.
Right.
As Sister said, they're survivors. They've learned to cope for the most part and figure out a way to do it. But by the standards of those of us sitting here in this nice warm room, it's not
right.
viable at all. It's tragic. There's no other word except to say it's tragic, you know, that people are in that kind of situation. And I think it's a situation that isn't fully understood in our area, that there are a lot of people who are homeless and don't always fit the stereotype that maybe we have of the homeless people. That, I mean, there's also single mothers with children who are struggling to find a place to be. There are families who've lost their home. There are single people who are working but aren't earning enough money to pay the rent. So there are a lot of people who are kind of right there on the edge that are homeless and could be even in worse shape, could be in the car or could be in a tent or in a shed or someplace like that if it were not for the shelters that were open.
You know, Don, actually it was just such a thing. It was a death in the Salisbury area.
Was there?
This was approximately 10 years ago when this
that's right.
first started. Oh. And that's what occasioned the very first kind of simple man-made put it all together.
Jerry-rigged, kind of, yes.
Jerry-rigged, that's a good word for it. That was the first. Yeah. And that was the beginning. And then people, you know, really took an awareness and took hold of the need.
Mm-hmm.
And since that time, it's been wonderful. You know, so many wonderful churches have become involved to prevent anything like that again.
I ran across a quote. It was from a Columbia University professor, Brandon O'Flaherty. In a book, he's making room, the economics of homelessness. And he wrote, although homelessness in the past was a phenomenon of economic depression, much of the rise in the new homelessness has occurred in relatively prosperous times. And that was actually up until, obviously, we had the Great Recession in 2008, 2009. But even as we saw then, it seems that homelessness was rising. I mean, John, what for you? You've seen more families, and I mean, is the composition changed over the say 10-year period?
Well, we've been operating at the top of the Interfaith Shelter for about 6 years,
mm-hmm.
and I wouldn't say there's been a dramatic change mm-hmm. in the composition of the people who come, but I think you've raised an important point. I mean, we've been talking about cold weather, and certainly that's when it's dramatically clear that people need shelter, but homelessness exists 12 months of the year, and it can be people akin to what you've described, people who've lost their home or through foreclosures and that kind of thing, or have lost a job, no longer have the income to pay the rent. And so there's I think consistent with what the Columbia University professor is describing, I think there is an emerging group of people that may have been there all along, but at least we're much more aware of it now. And I think the economic conditions in the past 4 or 5 years have exacerbated that problem and put more people literally on the street. And that, in that way, it's some different.
Sister Bridget, what about you? I mean, have you seen a change in this? Have you seen more? I know that there's some effort to obviously accommodate, particularly single women with children, which is a very special need in of itself. What kinds of people are you encountering?
You know, it's as different as each person. Some people, it's kind of like every family, every larger family has someone who just may not really be making it, and the family can kind of carry them. But these folks maybe don't have families who can do that for them. And you know, we of course try to encourage them to get help from their families if they can, but some of them, their families are pretty destitute too. And so we step in to try to take them to the next level. We make sure they survive and they can be warm and healthy, and we advocate for them, and we make sure they're getting the health care they need, and then hopefully get to the next step where they can approach having a stable place to live. But as you were saying, I mean, there's no one type. You know, there are all kinds of people with all kinds of issues. Most of them gentle, intelligent people.
Yeah.
You know, we become quite fond of them. Unfortunately, we've known some of them for quite a while.
And we've also seen vets come through. Yeah,
yes.
That's been
yeah.
a population that has
that's
been
true.
Expanding and growing.
That is an increasing group.
Some just haven't re-entered, you know, into the world that they left, you know, before they went into the Afghanistans and the Irans and the Fallujahs and all
right.
these places that have kind of crushed their spirits and their minds.
I mean, what is it, you're talking about the veterans, what are they like?
One foot in front of another sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
And there are times when they fall into an addictive personality.
Mm-hmm.
They pick up because, as many people feel, you know, any kind of an addiction kind of temporarily halts the world around them, or it makes it brighter or lighter or something. So it's not a difficult pattern to fall into sometimes. And sometimes, as I said, they just put one foot in front of the other. They survive. They live. And they don't see any real worth or value. They can't always lay aside what they left behind.
What about assistance for them? I mean, you would think that the Veterans Administration and so on would be there, but I mean, what?
There are people who will take advantage of it. There are people who won't.
Why
and
is
that's
that?
That's for various and sundry reasons. Some people just don't want to be takers or receivers or in need. Even though they are in need, they don't want to admit that there is such a thing. They don't want to do the extra work that's involved in that. There's nothing maybe local enough to support them or buoy them up. We have transported people up to Cambridge.
Mm-hmm.
We've had veterans come through, for instance, the Joseph House Workshop,
mm-hmm.
which is our transitional
yeah.
living place. And sometimes they do okay if they have enough interior support, but to get them to that point, it is tough sometimes.
What about you, John? I mean, when you handle veterans, I mean, and any example come to mind, how difficult it is for some of these?
Well, the good news is I think there are some programs that are beginning to be developed in Cambridge and elsewhere where really some comprehensive approaches to helping the veteran, housing and guidance and kind of how to get back on track and how to find jobs and that kind of thing. But I think we all hear and see on TV about the wars in Afghanistan or Iraq or wherever, but I think it very hard for us to appreciate the enormous shock for a person who's been over there and coming back out of that kind of environment and landing in Salisbury or Easton or wherever, and now they're supposed to be functioning just like all the rest of us. And I think it's that enormous transition challenge. It isn't that easy to step out of spending your life in a war in the middle of the deserts in Afghanistan and suddenly be back on the eastern shore of Maryland. And so I think what we see is just that transition challenge, that these are, in disaster services, we used to always talk about that people were having a normal reaction to an abnormal situation, okay? When they go through a disaster, they're all stressed out, and that's a very normal reaction. And I think much of what we see with the returning veterans is it's a normal reaction to a very abnormal demand for a transition. And that, as sisters are describing, that's the challenge, is helping them find ways to kind of get their feet back on the ground and feel some sense of support from their family or from supportive agencies, to just begin to feel safe and secure and, oh, okay, now I know how to reintegrate.
And it has a lot to do with the fragility of the person and the fragility of the mind and the mindset. Each war, we've had multiple wars, way back in the, it's called a Great War.
Right.
There have been those types of accommodations that people have to make when they reenter. However, I think sometimes when people have a harder time buying into the present war or the present situation in which they're placed, and see so many what they call collateral damage. That's such a scary term, because it's human persons that they're talking about. And I think that's what strikes some of the people that come back that just can't get through that. They see the humanity. They don't always relate to the inhumanity that came before. Because as we said, some of those bigger wars encompass so many countries and communities and families, and they hit home so much harder. It's really tough. This war has presented
the other thing that also strikes me about this war is that there are multiple tours that you might have gone, even like the Second World War. You might have been in for 3 or 4 years, and then ultimately then you came out, where here you had multiple tours. Mm-hmm. And the other thing is that when you do come back from, say, the war, you instantly come back.
Right.
There's no transition, such as, again, the Second World War. Troops had ways, they had to get on boats, they had to go, so there was a transitioning down, whereas here, you're in Fallujah one day, and you're on the eastern shore the next. I mean, that must be dramatic.
And it's tough on the families, too. I mean, it's not only the person returning, but it's the families back here who have had to cope with them being gone and constantly worrying about how they are and are they safe. And so I think it's, in some ways, a culture shock even for the family when someone comes back. Figuring out how do you communicate with a person who's gone through what they've gone through, and the person who's returning trying to figure out, okay, how do I explain what I went through, or do I even want to explain what I went through? So it's a dynamic situation. I think that's the value of the kinds of programs that you're providing, for example, because it's giving people a chance to just kind of settle in, okay, and gradually reintegrate. And I think that's a very important step.
We were talking a moment ago about the fact that many of these veterans are homeless. What is the role of their families in all of this? As you mentioned a moment ago, that, I mean, obviously we have government services, that's one support system, but there's also families. Do we find that there are veterans who wind up being homeless who still have families, but there's no connection? I mean, what happens there? Any thoughts about that?
I guess the short answer is I really don't know the numbers, terms of how often that's happening. I think there, certainly we know that is happening, that there are families that just can't cope with what's required of them. But I think it's more likely that it's a single individual or a person who maybe making the choice themselves that they're not ready to integrate back into the family, and just trying to figure out a way to get their feet on the ground and understand what's going on in their head and what's going on in their world when they're back here. And that, and in some ways it's an extreme example, but I think it's an example of what many of the homeless experience. Okay, it isn't as dramatic as what we're talking about in terms of returning veterans, but I think that many of the homeless that we see are people who, they didn't think they were going to be homeless, okay? That wasn't what they planned for their life. And now suddenly find themselves in a situation that is almost incomprehensible. I mean, how could it be that we can't afford to have a house, or we can't pay the rent, or I got into this marriage and I thought it was wonderful and it turned out to be abusive? And I mean, how could that possibly be? And so I think we're with all of the, or almost all of the people that we're dealing with who are homeless, it's helping them cope with this phenomenon for which they are just totally unprepared and don't have a handle on how to deal with it. And I think, as the sister said, really our, for all of us and all of the agencies working with the homeless, really our objective is to help them become self-sufficient and have a home of their own and be able to care for themselves. But it's that transition and kind of the shock from being in the situation they're in and figuring out, I didn't think I needed to know how to interview for a job. Okay, I assumed I'd have a job. Or right. I didn't think I'd be in an abusive relationship, or I'd have to have our kids staying with family because we can't afford to have a place for all of us to be at the same time. I mean, that, it's hard for us who aren't in that situation to understand how emotionally impactful that kind of experience is.
One of the things that has developed, I know when I started covering this story here on the shore about 10 years ago, there began to see an emergence of more and more single women with children, particularly children. And you'll have children who sort of grow up almost partially in these environments where they're homeless. Give us a sense, I'll start with you, Sister Virginia. What are the special needs here for these women, and how do they cope, especially if they have children? Because it's not just themselves that they have to then figure out where they're going to go, but they have this extra responsibility that certainly they feel like they have to deal with, because obviously they've brought the children along. What is that all about?
Well, I have a very narrow window working in this particular place. And I see women come in sometimes with children, and I don't know what their situation is. We have in Salisbury an organization called the Village of Hope, which the Little Sisters of Jesus and Mary started. Now it's a standalone nonprofit. And there, they take in, with an interview process, women and children who basically are homeless. They've been a product of an abusive relationship, and they don't have any place to go. Also single women, but women and children. And it's very difficult. The women go there, they have to work, they need care for their children. It's only a 2-year program. During that time, they have to get regularized and employed and stabilized. And often they just seem to be unprepared for that kind of a life. But Sister Marilyn actually knows more about the village.
Sister Marilyn?
Well, sometimes, as John mentioned earlier, there are the hidden homeless, and sometimes women and women with children get to be that more hidden homeless because they're living in with family. And it's really not a situation where they can even stabilize. Number one, there's not enough place in the house for them. Especially with extra children on hand. And also, sometimes these parents even live in situations where they can't have extra children in the house. Mm. They can stay and they can visit for a while, but they can't stay there. So they're there only temporarily. So they need the stabilization. Sometimes they've had children early, you know, before high school is completed, or there's any chance at completing their educations in any sort. So they have to have a GED. They have to go further than someone who's done their matriculation and gone through high school and or even some college. So there's a longer way to go. And maybe they haven't even been able to get the training they need in being a mother and a wife and and a housekeeper in particular. So there are a lot of little journeys they have to make. There's not near enough room or near enough rooms for all these women that are out there. They have 15 apartments over there. They do give them some wonderful class and experience and opportunities there. There's counseling over there. There's tutoring over there for the children. We get involved with the schools. So the village does a lot. The counterpart is a Joseph House Workshop for Men, where we can, fortunate, we can segue some of our homeless men into that program. That's another two-year program, which Sister Elizabeth always wanted stabilization of family life to be the most central. You only start with the basics. You feel the basic needs, and then you try to move on and grant them opportunities and abilities to use their own resources and gain their own resources so they can live out in community again.
What kind of impact do you see this having on the children? It seems like a very odd existence.
Well, yes, it is. I think that's one of the challenges that the mother and the examples we're citing faces is, some instances a single father with children, but figuring out how to be a single parent who's a two parent, and I think many children are remarkably resilient, and I think if the parent or parents can be stabilized, then the children can be stabilized. But I think we have a similar program to what you were describing, Sister, in Ridgely, the St. Martin's, and they also have a program for mothers with children. In Talbot County, we've faced the challenge, and it gets to your question, in that the mother and her children are in Talbot County, and they could go to St. Martin's in Ridgely, but their children are in the Easton school system, perhaps in special needs programs or whatever, and the debate is, am I better off taking my children out of that program and being in Ridgely, or am I better staying in Easton where the kids can continue in the school program with which they're accustomed? So I think parents are constantly struggling to create some stability for their kids, and often that's the choice they make. The Talbot Interface Shelter has acquired, working with the Housing Commission of Talbot, a couple of apartments where we can put temporarily a mother with children, but it's temporary at best, and it doesn't, there are no, in Talbot County, there are no transitional housing facilities for families, none. There is a transitional housing program for six single people, okay? So it doesn't, the resources, physical resources, just physically don't exist to address, as you were saying, there are just more single mothers with children and more single men and single women and families who need the kinds of services and support we're trying to describe, and the physical resources are not there.
Why is that? That's one of the things that struck me. I mean, as a matter of fact, Sister and I were talking about it a moment ago. 10 years ago, there were a couple of deaths, and churches got together, and there were some assistance. And one of the things that struck me as someone who just got here was, well, that's odd that the city or the county or some of the folks, the governmental structures, weren't there providing something for at least a lot of these people, particularly during the coal period. Now, obviously, the civic, part of the society has stepped up in terms of the religious institutions, such as churches. But there does seem to be, but that's about it. I mean, it's not that the city isn't helping out, but there doesn't, I would seem to think there would be more. I mean, I don't know.
It's a leaky safety net, I would say.
Yeah, that's a very good description.
Yeah.
Well, some of it, I mean, it's, somewhere marginally a political question you're asking, because it, you know, the there's a an emergency food and shelter program at the federal level,
right?
And the funding for that has been cut consistently over the last 7 or 8 years. It just kind of keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller in terms of the amount of money that's available. I think some of it is that we've never been as effective as we need to be in helping people understand that there is homelessness, and that there's an investment that we can make to try and reduce that homelessness. And we could probably fault ourselves for not doing as good a job as we need to do in communicating that need. At the Top of the Interface Shelter, we're right on the cusp of submitting some proposals to federal agencies, primarily, to build or acquire a facility so that we can begin to meet the need that's there. But the funds are sort of scattered around in bits and pieces, and I don't know that it's people. I don't think it's the governmental agencies being cold-hearted or we're just going to let people suffer or something. I don't think it's that. Or at least not a lot of that. Maybe some, but not a lot. But I think it's just not understanding the nature of the challenge, and that it really is an investment that we can make. That if we can invest in helping the people we're talking about stabilize and get a handle on themselves and their lives, and learn how to apply for a job and learn how to save money and all those kinds of issues, that's an investment that more than pays for itself when they're able to become self-sufficient. And I don't think that message has been clear.
You know, I think part of the education process for people is getting involved. And it doesn't mean a huge involvement of time and resources, but if someone feels they have a heart for the homeless or for the poor, a good thing to do is to find out what is going on in your neighborhood, where you work or where you live. What is your local church doing? What's the local library doing? These local libraries are amazing.
Yeah.
I mean, some of our homeless people go in there, they get warm, they can use the computer, they can look for jobs, they can look for resources. And the library staff help them. It's really extraordinary. So if people knew what was going on and had a better understanding of what people need and what they don't need, let's say, then the problem wouldn't seem so huge, and we wouldn't fall into our usual kind of cliched ways of thinking about it. I think we would understand it right on the ground, and we can respond with volunteering or just money or buying goods or food, and then I think a public that understands, that actually sees the homeless face to face, that see the poor face to face, can then participate in the political process with some knowledge, and it won't seem so huge. It's really only as big as your neighborhood, in a way. If everyone were a bit involved, it would make an enormous difference.
Did you think that we tend to be, at least in this country, tend to be live too isolated?
I think people are overwhelmed by the idea of it, and they're afraid to venture in and see what it's really like, because it seems so scary and huge. But it isn't, in a way.
You use a lot of volunteers in your program, I think.
We are tremendously dependent on volunteers. It's a miracle how many people volunteer for us and keep things going. There are only 7 little sisters.
Yeah.
We could never do it without our hundreds of volunteers.
Yeah, we use 400 volunteers a year who are preparing meals and staying with the people who are in our shelters, at least from roughly 5 o'clock at night to 11 o'clock at night before some other people come in to take the overnight duty. So I think you're right. I think those 400 people now better understand homelessness, and they understand what it means to be homeless. And they're sitting around a table like we are, talking with people who look just like they do,
yes,
okay,
exactly.
Who just don't have a place to live
right.
And don't have a way to get a meal. And so I think, and the congregations that we work with is another way in which people begin to understand, oh, okay. So I think kind of the one step at a time sort of approach, you spread out among our 400 volunteers, and they talk to their friends, and their friends talk to their friends. That's one way in which it gets spread. But again, you know, for in our case, we are able to only take five people at a time because we're moving from church, from faith community facility to faith community facility, and the fire codes only allow us to have five people in there at a time. And but we're getting 213 calls. So, and I think all of us are in that situation, and we need kind of more resources. As you're saying, we need more volunteers. We need more space. We need more financial support to try and begin to address the problem.
Well, the other thing that shows is a caring heart. It shows the face of God, and it tells people that there is a God out there who loves them very much. And sometimes you can only see that through another human person's face. Mm-hmm. And we can't shove everything on the government, on this association, and you don't always want the ties that bind when it comes to some programs. It's good to freely and independently and voluntarily mm-hmm. do something for someone else without any complexity, so to speak.
I have to ask Pope Francis. Emphasis on the poor. I mean, it's a remarkable shift from certainly some of the popes I've seen just recently in the past. I want to certainly get your impression of him particularly in terms of this, what seems to be a shift in emphasis, not necessarily doctrine, but emphasis that he has placed. And also, just recently, I guess, the Pope got himself into a bit of a scrap over unfettered capitalism, which he was a bit of a critic. He said, wait a minute, maybe we got to. So, I'll just start with you, Sister Marilyn. First of all, what's your impression of the Pope in this, what seems to be a change in emphasis? Not that the church has not been there all this time, because it has been, but nonetheless, there seems to be something different going on.
I think we loved and embraced him from the beginning. The very first thing he did is go out before this massive group, you know, not only on television, but in the audience before him, and he asked for prayers and blessings for him. And I think that immediately, you know, embraced him to the whole population, because he was humble. He knows that this is a massive cloak being placed on his shoulders, and he knows that he needs the support and prayers of others. And so many things that he said and done. He lives it. He walks the walk, and he talks the talk, and that's what people relate to. They hear what they see, and they believe.
Well, of course, he came out of Argentina, out of Buenos Aires, which has the highest rate of plastic surgery in the world. So he has also the highest rate of psychiatry. So he comes, not that America, America also.
I think we're coming in there, yeah.
America's a very generous place, and businesses are very generous. But it's true, it's tempting to think that the free market is going to solve everything. If you just have a nice, robust free market. But, you know, we know that's not true, even in our own families. You know, as helpful as our families can be, they're just as usually somebody who's having problems, having struggles. So there have to be, we have to open our hearts to those who just don't have enough resources of any kind to manage in a fairly difficult world. As we say, rents are just terribly high. I mean, I'm sure we've all seen that house prices and rents have gone up exponentially compared to incomes in the last 20, 30 years. That's certainly been my experience. And at the same time, when manual labor is, there are fewer and fewer jobs of that kind. So people kind of fall between the cracks. It seems like we're getting more and more prosperous, but there's a certain level of, there's certain kinds of work that have simply disappeared, and people may not always be suitable for the kinds of jobs that are out there, that are plentiful. too. So,
you know, I just have to add, Sister Mary Elizabeth, our foundress, used to tell people, you know, when they were donating and giving things, she said, just think of the wonderful bank account you're accumulating up in heaven. And you know, there's truth in that. as God can never be outdone in his giving, and he just asked us to do the same.
John, what do you think about the Pope and this emphasis, this shift of emphasis, and this whole discussion about unfettered capitalism? And I mean, some people took umbrage with the statement, but I mean, what's your impressions about what this dialogue is taking place?
Well, as a non-Catholic, I think I certainly was pleased and warmed by his emphasis on the poor and on people who need help and support, and that's very encouraging. I think, yeah, stimulated maybe even partly by what he said, it's turned into almost a kind of intellectual discussion about income disparities.
Yeah.
and that, I guess that's an issue that needs to be addressed in its own right, but I think it sort of misses the, and certainly he stimulated us to think about the individuals who are being impacted. But I think we as a culture need to also sort of say, okay, let's just talk about people who need help, okay?
Yeah.
Let's forget the labels and, you know, whether we call it disparity in income or whatever we go, or whether it's even done by free enterprise or done by government. Let's talk about people who need some help.
Our neighbors.
And what are the best ways to go about doing that? And some of it is certainly part of the free market process. I mean, as you were saying, there are certainly private companies and individuals who donate enormous amounts of money and time and energy and volunteers to work with the kinds of people we're describing. But I think so far it's not proven to be sufficient. That there needs to be some governmental ways of filling in the gaps and addressing the needs of people who just aren't able to cope without some additional help. So I think the Pope stimulated some very healthy discussion that needed to occur and put an emphasis where I, working with the homeless, I'm pleased he put an emphasis, okay?
But one of the other things, and one of the other moments here, of course, this week marks the 50th anniversary of President Lyndon Johnson's State of the Union address, in which he declared a war on poverty. And we're 50 years now on, at least one Republican senator has basically said that it's not worked, time to try new other things, that being not worked in the sense of the government programs. What's your reflection about the idea that we've had this war on poverty, that was begun in the 1960s, and has it been successful? I mean, we know that, for instance, we do know poverty, for instance, there was like something like 25% in before Johnson's war on poverty. That dropped down to about 15, and it's hovered somewhere around that ever since, to give some people some sense of the statistics. But what's your sense about the government and this debate that we seem to be having, where we do seem to have political movements to say, no, we shouldn't be doing this, or government shouldn't be involved, as opposed to Johnson's idea that, no, we should utilize government, certainly in a New Deal fashion, I suspect, for him, to help out people. But John, what about you? What's your? I'm going to go to you first, and then I'll.
Thank you
I'll
for setting me up with that.
I'll give them a few minutes to think about it.
A few words.
Yeah. Right. Well, I don't know that I'm qualified to assess Johnson's policies,
anyway,
but I think.
But where we are.
From my point of view, there are gaps that exist that we have not found ways to deal with sufficiently, simply on a private sector basis, that there are needs, and that we need governmental interventions begin to address those needs. Now, again, it can't all be done by government, not remotely, but I also don't think it can all be done on a private basis, at least as of right now. You know, if 20 years from now we've succeeded in creating the kind of mindset that engenders that degree of private support, wonderful. I think we'd all say that's far better. But right now, it's clear, you know, that we, if it weren't for our volunteers, and if it weren't for some governmental support for some of the programs that people need, they wouldn't survive.
I agree. I would hate to see certain programs go away, like food stamps, like subsidized housing, like even these cell phones that people are provided with. I mean, if you are homeless or living in a precarious position, can't pay your bills, how are you going to get to the doctor? How are you going to get a job if you don't have a phone? There aren't any pay phones anymore. So that these phones that people are provided with, poor people are provided with, are part of the package of really necessities now that the government is providing. And they're not living like Rockefeller. I mean, it's pretty stark. But it's a way for them to at least survive, to be able to move on to the next step and get what they need to begin to thrive.
And I would so encourage us to find some resources for jobs.
Hmm.
People are willing to work. Most people want to earn their own living, to take care of themselves, take care of their family. But the jobs are like made in America. Put some of that energy and effort into some of our home resources too. We need to. Charity begins at home, mm-hmm. and it spreads out from there. When home is comfortable, then people will give outside. And I wish the jobs program would really begin and thrive. We need some good, solid manufacturing, some solid, ordinary, everyday jobs. Everywhere,
yeah,
and not just in our area.
I think, you know, as I was saying earlier, we're right on the edge of trying to figure out a way to buy or build a property that could begin to give some capacity to deal with the homeless. I can't picture the necessary funds for that all coming from the private sector. Okay, I think it's going to be grants from the federal government, state government, and others that are at least very important ingredient in helping us be able to achieve that vision. Now, I also expect we'll get an enormous amount of private support, okay? And in that way, a partnership between private and governmental and public contributions and resources. But I think it's, maybe that's the phrase, a partnership. I just can't picture it being an all or none deal. It can't be all government, and I don't think it can be all private. I think it's really got to, and maybe that's what Johnson was trying to accomplish with the war on property. I won't speak to that. I don't know for sure, but I think it's that kind of working together and partnership that is going to be required.
So do you see the efforts to deal with the homeless getting any better, or do you feel like you're falling behind in terms of the demand? I mean, we've certainly had a certain upsurge in demand, certainly during the recession. I mean, that's clearly, we saw that. I mean, I've talked to some families. I remember talking to one man in particular. I think he had been out of work for about a year, worked at one of the yards where they build boats, and you could see as I interviewed him, he was almost came to tears, this idea that he was now having to go to a church to get some food. And it was clearly he was one of those people, as you say, would not expect to have to seek food from a church, much less the potential for, say, homelessness. Are we getting any better, further ahead, or are we still slipping behind? What's your sense about that, John? What do you think? I mean, what are you seeing out there?
Well, I think at the local level, we're getting ahead in a recognition of the problem. I don't think we're getting ahead in our capacity, particularly to serve it in the physical space and financial resources and other. But I think there is a broadened awareness of the challenge, and I think our hope is that that will in turn stimulate the resource or getting some of the resources needed to do it. So it's easier for me to almost speak of it at the local level, because we're working with a lot of all the other agencies in the area that are dealing with the homeless in some ways, and we've really developed some marvelous partnerships with those other agencies. We really work well together, and support each other, and try to fill each other's gaps as best we can. So I think that's exciting to see. I think that's happening very effectively. The financial part of the question, it gets to, well, what the country's been going through in the last six, 8 years, in the last year. Funding's being cut. It's that simple, okay? So in that sense, you know, at a national level, are we getting better at dealing with the issue, at least on a financial basis? You'd have to say flat out no, that we're actually cutting back from dealing with the issue. So, and maybe that gets to what the sister was saying, you know, it's fundamentally local, that if we can, on the Delmarva principle, get each of our communities saying this is a need and this is what we got to do to address that need, and support the agencies that are trying to do it, volunteer with them, make financial contributions to them, whatever, support the agencies that are dealing with it in Salisbury and in Cambridge and in Easton, you know, then maybe that's where we cope. Maybe that's where we start.
And you know that this area is one of the most generous. Philanthropy on this Lower Shore area is tremendous. Yep. We stack up with some of the biggest cities in the whole United States. And we have wonderful agencies here. You know, we have the Halos and the Hopes and the people on the ground, and we have the wonderful Christian Shelter.
And we meet regularly too with the agencies to coordinate and not try to duplicate services. And
you know what we found at Joseph House, and I'm sure other agencies have found the same. As they say, when the going gets tough, the tough get going, and the tough get generous and they get gracious and the heart's open and the wallet's open.
It's amazing.
And they see sometimes what they can't do, they see that we can be the segue to help accomplish some of that.
Yeah.
So they do. They do support
us. One funny thing, one lady who loves to shop has channeled her obsession with shopping to shopping for the homeless. So we see regularly these big piles of razors and deodorant and soaps and shampoos and things that she buys for us, and toothbrushes. It's great.
It's almost weekly, almost every Saturday.
Well, and I think that's an interesting example. I think ultimately, particularly if we talk about acquiring space and everything else, we need big contributions. But I think all of us flourish on, quote, the small distribution. I mean, we were talking earlier about at Talbot Interface Shelter, the $50 checks we get that sustain us, okay? The 400 or 500 people writing a $50 check or a $25 check has a huge impact. And I think that's true of all of the agencies on the Eastern Shore, that the quote, small donor, that's diminishing it more than I wish it to be diminished. The donor who's able to make that $25 contribution or that $50 contribution is making a major difference, a profound difference in organizations like those of us who are here today.
So, I mean, is there more, do you think, that can be done on the shore? Do you think there's more that can be done on the shore to help, particularly with the homeless? But I mean, because we see governments, obviously, for example, are very strapped. And you indicated a moment ago, there are cuts. We have the sequester, we have the debate over food stamps. Looks like there'll be some cuts there. Is there anything more that we can do on the shore in terms of the homeless, do you think?
Well, from my point of view, in Talbot County, at least, the overwhelming issue is just is physical capacity. We need space for people to be we need it to be available 365 days a year and 24 hours a day. You know, the overwhelming majority of the programs are, including our own, are just for cold weather or overnight or parts of the day, and we just aren't, we don't have the resources now available to provide the place mm-hmm. where these services can be delivered, where for transitional housing programs and for shelter that's available during the day and not just overnight. And you know, it's just a fundamental problem that we are putting people up in hotels, or we're scrambling to find a place we can put them in for 2 or 3 days or for a month or two. We have to find places where people can settle in, as you were sort of saying, instead of trying to live with family, other family members, or with friends or whatever, that doesn't work for very long. They need a place to live and to transition. And there are that's different from permanent low-income housing. It's
right.
Transitional housing, where people can settle in and where social services can be provided and job seeking guidance can be provided and financial planning can be provided and child management care yeah. can be provided, all those kinds of things, where there's just a place where they can be, and maybe just for 6 months, maybe for a year or so, as they get things under control in their lives. And we don't, in Talbot County, we do not have those resources. They just don't exist.
Why is that?
That's the hardest piece. I think that's why.
That's a
difficult thing to do.
And it's expensive.
Yeah.
Okay. It requires more than $50 checks in order to do it. I think that's one reason. It gets to what we were all talking about earlier. I think it's just an awareness of the issue and a misunderstanding, you know, a sense of, oh, we're just giving somebody a place to be when they should be out on their own in some other way. And again, maybe our failures in really communicating how the need exists. But I think that's fundamentally why. I think we just haven't recognized. You know, Talbot County has a picture in many people's minds as being extraordinarily wealthy. There are certainly lots of very wealthy people who are there, and there's also lots of poverty there. And there are people who are in between, who are the homeless people that we've been talking about earlier, that just sort of suddenly find themselves there. And there just isn't the awareness that that exists. So we just got to let people know and be prepared to support it.
Some of our churches do more than simply house the homeless during the winter. They have different kinds of programs. They have NA, AA. They have other kinds of sort of spiritual building up of people. Mm-hmm. Certain individual pastors are just saintly men who get involved in people's lives and go the extra mile for them all the time and to help them to hopefully become more independent and to kind of join the mainstream. And I think there's a lot of opportunity for creative thinking on the part mm-hmm. of church congregations and individuals and agencies and organizations. I hope that this basic safety net will stay. The homeless do also get some health care. Everything, you know, health care, of course, is in turmoil right now.
Right.
But I just hope that people have it in their heart to keep this safety net there for people, because otherwise it would be really hard for them to move forward in their lives. But I think individuals who care can play a very creative and exciting role in developing ways to bring these people forward.
Sister Marilyn, would we?
I'm going to leave you with one little anecdote from Sister Mary Elizabeth.
Okay.
Who we were invited to receive a check from the American Legion. And at that particular time, the commander was saying, "Sister, we have a check for you, but aren't you a little bit wary about receiving what some people call tainted money?" Sister, quick on her feet, says, The only trouble with this money is it taint enough.
Well, we've been speaking with sisters at Virginia Peckham and Marilyn Bouchard from Joseph's House, as well as John Clisby. He is with the Talbot Interfaith Shelter. And also, by the way, before I go, so there are a group of churches that are participating. Can you give us a sense about what's going on with that right now?
Right now, let's see, is the last day of Wesley Temple in mm-hmm. Salisbury. Tomorrow, Cross Point Church of the Nazarene will be housing the homeless men. And because they're a little out of town, on Nanticoke Road, transportation will be provided if men can be picked up at a certain point. And there's a great resource, 211. So people, homeless people, poor people, people who want to help, people in need, people in crisis can call 211 and they will be directed to the cold shelter for men or any kind, all the services that are available in, I believe, in Maryland, isn't it?
Mm-hmm. Okay.
But they can pinpoint it by zip code. So.
Well, we've been talking about the homeless and also certain about poverty. And we want to all, of course, keep all those people who are less fortunate in our prayers and in our thoughts. This has been Del Marva Today. I'm Don Rush, and thanks for listening.
This has been Del Marva Today, a production of Del Marva Public Radio. Chris Rank produces and is our audio engineer. Our volunteer producers are Penny Hartman, Kathleen Grout, and Jim White. Don Rush is your host. For podcasts, visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, or subscribe to the Del Marva Today podcast in iTunes. Del Marva Today can now be seen on PAC 14. To view the schedule, visit the Daily Times or visit PAC14.org.